Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm delighted to have back as my guest today Stephen White, and we will be discussing his novel Dry Ice, published by Dutton. And we will also make mention of his previous novel, Kill Me, which will now be available in trade paperback. And first of all, Stephen, thank you so much for taking time to appear with us again today.
Casey, it's my pleasure. I look forward to the conversation.
You know, I reread Kill Me over the weekend, and I think, looking back on it, I think it was a brilliant idea that you had with Dry Ice. When writing Kill Me, I think, was a good idea for you, because it just kind of seemed to give you a little break from the characters that you write about. And when I was reading Dry Ice, they just seemed to have more of a, like they'd all been on vacation or something like that.
You know, I didn't leave them behind intentionally in order to write Kill Me, but the narrative, the story that I had in my head when I wrote it pretty much required that the series characters and the backstory associated with them disappear for a while. One of the benefits of that for me was that it did provide me a vacation from a certain kind of series architecture, from the voices that those characters bring to the narrative, and everything did feel fresher when I revisited everyone in starting Dry Ice. So I totally agree with the premise. I don't take much credit for it because it wasn't intentional, but I think it all turned out to be true.
Yeah, I agree. So Dry Ice is, we're not going to give any of the plot elements away, because there's some pretty surprising twists and turns, but we can talk about it in general terms. And one of the things that will jump out to your longtime readers is that Michael McClelland is back in Alan Gregory's life. And if you would, tell us a little bit about Michael McClelland and his history with Alan Gregory.
The first book in the series, and, you know, I say that and almost want to put it in quotes, because the first book novel that I wrote was called Privileged Information. And when I wrote it, I had no intention of it being the first book of a series. I didn't allow myself the fantasy of thinking that I had a series in me or would ever have the opportunity to write one, certainly not one this long. Michael McClelland was the character I invented as the antagonist in Privileged Information, that first book. And his role was relatively simple. He was intended to provide a foil for the character I was developing simultaneously, Alan Gregory. And Michael was a brilliant guy with a very troubled history, and I really wanted him to be the kind of adversary that would allow me to highlight certain parts of Alan Gregory's character. And that's really how Michael developed.
Okay. And he is a frightening character, and the thought of having someone like that loose in your life again is a person's worst nightmare, particularly in light of the fact that there are children involved now.
Yeah, Michael is brilliant. He's determined, and he is maniacal in almost no ways except in terms of his focus. And those things make him a very significant adversary for Alan. I revisited him, not so much because I find Michael a fascinating character, but because I wanted to revisit the impact that someone like Michael would have on Alan after all the character development that's occurred to Alan Gregory's character over the previous 14 books. So revisiting Michael was a way to hold a measuring stick up to Alan. It wasn't really intended as a way to see how Michael had evolved over the years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a quote you had in there which I just loved, and it said, most of psychology isn't complicated. It's just stuff grandmothers know. And I like that because at times the plot becomes very complicated, but some of it is at its base it is the kind of things we learn as we mature and we get older, in that our grandmothers taught us, and I like that line that jumped out at me when I read that.
One of the things I've tried to do since I started writing the first book was to make things that psychologists talk about that seem complicated, make them seem simple. And the best way that I've found to do that is to allow people to experience them through the familiar. Any psychological principle of any worth is going to have resonance for people in their own lives. And by trying to find the common denominator of those experiences, I can really help people understand perhaps some of the arcane language that psychologists use. And when you boil much of it down, it should leave people nodding their heads, saying, I knew that. Mm-hmm. Very little of what psychologists do is surprising. It is everyday knowledge, and parents and grandparents and all of us bring psychological principles into what we do every day. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I like about Dry Ice is it really, I think, deals very, very well with the concept and the way that we keep secrets. And there's just a brief quote. It said, secrets usually aren't as important as our motivation for keeping them. I should have been thinking about the motivations for secret. Tops on the list. For years I've argued that the top of the spot on the list was reserved for shame. But it's control, specifically the control we lose when we free secrets from their locked dens.
Dry Ice is about secrets. As the book was being conceptualized in my head, this book was about secrets and the power of secrets. And not just major, deep, dark secrets, but the universality of secrets that... that everybody has something they don't want someone to know. And the currency, the vocabulary of Dry Ice, the power of the story, the leverage that everyone attempts to use on other people, and that everyone is trying to keep from being discovered, has to do with secrets. That's really what the story is about, and I tried to keep my eye on that ball right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, that as the story develops, the secrets start to build, and some of them are old, and some of them are intentionally manipulative, and some of them are just things that have become parts of people's characters. Mm-hmm. And I try and look at them from as many different angles as I can, but yeah, that's what this book is about.
Yeah, really, that's what I really came away from it. And as I was reading it, we all keep secrets. And sometimes I say to myself, why do I keep that as a secret? And it's really I think it's a fear that people won't love us if we tell them our secrets. But oddly enough, when we take the risk and share the secret, oddly enough, oftentimes we're closer to that person.
Yes. One of the things that the book really tries to explore is whether there's an invisible line that people cross when they keep secrets, where the fact that they've been keeping a secret becomes much more powerful than the knowledge that they have been keeping secret. Mm-hmm. And the impact of that on relationships, of crossing that invisible line, is a big part of what Alan and Lauren and Sam are dealing with during this story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, because, again, without giving anything away, Lauren has some insecurities, and as any married couple does, and it's not, sometimes it's that just wanting to know, you know, are you keeping a secret from me? Is there something going on? And those are the moments, I think, where we really, you know, prove that we're committed to a relationship, you know, or that we're not. And sometimes the reason we're keeping the secret, when we tell the other person, they just say, you've got to be kidding me.
Right. You know, the secrets become magical. And I think there's an allusion in the book comparing secrets to that famous scene in The Wizard of Oz, and where the curtain gets pulled back. And, you know, the power of keeping secrets ends up having little to do with the facts that are being obscured. It has to do with, as you said, the fear of not being loved, the fear of losing control, the fear of how someone's going to be viewed if the knowledge becomes public. And sure, there's some times where it's true that the facts might be that destructive, but more often it's the psychological fear of disclosure, and that's what people are trying to keep at bay, the power that they imbue.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, let's talk for a moment in Dry Ice, published by Dutton, and in a lot of your other, in all of your other books. You have a great love affair with dogs, as I do, and again, not giving anything away, but there's something healing about a dog, and there's something, dogs don't keep secrets, I don't think.
Dogs don't keep secrets, and the dogs, you know, they play a role in my life, but they play a very specific role in the books, and that is that they tend to show up in the stories when people are acting very not dog-like. And by not dog-like, I mean, you know, our dogs are reliable. We can pretty much count on the way they're going to behave. And we can count on their affection. We can count on their trust. We can count on their instincts. And very often, the dogs will appear in the stories as a counterpoint to some person or another in the story who's not acting with any of those characteristics. So, you know, just as they ground me in my life, they provide an opportunity as a literary device to ground the story in a different way and let the characters, specifically usually Alan Gregory, get grounded again through what the dog can provide.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize that you used it to that extent as a literary device.
Well, take a look, you know, again, we don't want to give away the story, but Take a look at the appearance of the new dog at the end of the book.
Oh, yeah.
And when that dog shows up and what the dog provides.
Yeah.
You'll get some sense of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every time I do an interview, I have to put my Beagle Karma in her cage because she snores so loudly that the microphones pick it up. But people that love dogs, I think they're just... They're gifts from God. They're just wonderful, wonderful beings, and I think I know I personally have learned a lot from dogs. But it's interesting to hear that you use them to help you with your plot development as well. That's very interesting, Stephen. When I was reading Dry Ice, there are so many a lot of secrets are revealed about several of the characters. There are some very dramatic moments that take place. And I can remember one time I was talking to Alice McDermott, and I said, do you ever worry that when you write a really good scene that you're not going to be able to follow it up with another good scene, that you're using your best bullets first? And when I was reading Dry Ice, I was thinking to myself, wow, I might have saved this or something because it was so powerful. But you were able to maintain that, you know, that progression of drama, that progression of intensity, of feeling, of emotion. And I commend you on that, because that's a very difficult thing to do, because you let out some pretty big guns early on in the story.
First of all, thank you. But, you know, I look at power in scenes perhaps in a slightly different way. And in a traditional thriller, I think action scenes have a specific meaning and provide a specific kind of anchor to a story. And I think they have to be used judiciously, because the action defines the story in a certain way and anchors it. And in many ways, if you put in too dramatic an action scene in a thriller, it is hard to move past it. The power of many of my scenes comes from almost an emotional thrill, mm-hmm. rather than an action thrill, although I like writing action scenes, and there are some in Dry Ice. The power comes from the dilemma that gets created, either interpersonally or intrapersonally. And I think the most powerful scenes that I write not only anchor the story, but they also provide an invitation to whatever comes next.
Mm-hmm.
So I rarely feel that a powerful scene sticks me in one place. It usually opens the curtain for something new as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm writing looking forward rather than looking back at what I've just done. And, you know, each time I do it, I hope that it works and count that I'm going to be able to take the story to another crescendo. And, you know, I'm just grateful when it seems I get to the end and I've been able to do it.
Yeah. The fact that you've had the series and obviously have the talent to do those helps as well. Stephen, with Kill Me, which, like I say, as Dry Ice, when it hits the stores and online, Kill Me will be available in trade paperback. What is it that you're happiest now that you've had a chance to kind of take a look back at what you did with Kill Me? What is it you're happiest about with taking kind of a little bit of a break with Kill Me, looking back on that? What did you learn the most from that, do you think?
You know, all along through the series, I've had support from editors and publishers to take risks. And you know, if I go back to the third book in the series, it was a pretty significant break from what I had done with the first two books. And even later on in the series, I've been able to have the freedom to play around with, you know, increasing and decreasing the prominence of Alan Gregory and other series characters in any given story I write. So I've had quite a bit of freedom. My fear when I conceptualized Kill Me was that I was going to be asking too much of my editor and my publisher, and that they were going to see it as too big a divergence from the series. I'm very grateful, number one, that they had the foresight to allow me to try and do it, because none of us, I think, really knew how it was going to turn out. From a writing point of view, I recognized, I think, very early on in the first 40 or 50 pages, that the structure of the story was going to be incredibly unusual, because it was going to be so nonlinear. And when I look back at the story, and now I've been able to absorb reader reaction to the story for a year, I'm very proud that I was able to write such a complicated story structure and do it in such a way that very, very, very few readers had any difficulty following it.
Mm-hmm.
That was my fear all along, is that telling the story the way I felt I had to tell it was going to force readers to pay attention in ways that they hadn't had to in my other books.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look back at the experience, I'm really grateful for the readers who got captivated enough early on in the story that they stuck with this book as it jumped literally from place to place. And I think most readers celebrated the jumps along with me, and that's been very gratifying. The biggest thing that would kill me is just the power of the premise.
And yes.
I can't tell you how many conversations I've had in the past year and a half with people who have just been moved by the premise and moved by what it says about, you know, life and death in contemporary society. And that's been incredibly gratifying.
Yes. And I also would like to put another plug in here, because I think that I know personally I recommended Not Fade Away, The Life of Peter Barton, to hundreds of people, and I had people write me and say I bought 5 or 6 copies for my niece and nephew. And I'm so glad that you brought Peter Barton, brought his life to more people's attention as well, because that is a jewel of a book, Not Fade Away by Peter Barton, and hopefully you know, it will live on for a longer period of time because of the effort you put in, or the acclaim you gave it in Kill Me, because it's just one of those books that just should be read. It's just a jewel of a book.
Well, obviously I agree with you completely, and for people who don't know, Not Fade Away is the story of the life and death of a man who became my friend and inspired the ideas that drew me to want to write Kill Me. And you know, as powerful a book as I consider Kill Me to be, in many ways the power of the living and dying experience could never be more clearly defined than in The Joyous Book. And although it's about Peter's death, it's really a joyous book.
Yeah, it really is.
That he wrote with Larry Shames, and I certainly recommend that everyone go out and track down a copy of Not Fade Away. It's just a lovely treatise on our lives and our deaths.
Yes, it really is. Well, you're listening to the Casey Kowar Show, A Celebration of Words. We've been talking today with Stephen White. We've been discussing Dry Ice, published by Dutton, and also Kill Me. And Stephen, congratulations on Dry Ice. I just think that you have a real winner here. It just has so many different levels of intrigue, and you took some risks with some of the characters, which I greatly admire. And as all good writers do, you've got me salivating now for the next one, because I want to find out what happens to everybody who's in the book, because it's kind of become this family, which really is starting to resemble more of the families that we have in America. I mean, this is the way our country is evolving, and I think it's exciting that you're doing this, and I look forward to seeing what happens with everybody down the road.
Well, thanks very much, Casey. You know, it's fun to talk about it, and, you know, I did take some risks with Dry Ice, and I shook the foundations under familiar characters for readers who have certain expectations of what these characters are like and where they're going. I think that there will be a lot of surprises for people as they read Dry Ice, and, you know, I'm excited about what's going to happen going forward as well.
Good. Well, thanks a lot, Stephen, and we will get caught up when the next book comes out. And again, congratulations, and for all the listeners out there, you do not want to miss Dry Ice. This is one you'll start, and 2 o'clock in the morning you'll be cursing us, saying, I should have waited until tomorrow to start this.
Thanks again, Casey.
Okay, take care, Stephen.